listening to theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to the last in our series of weekly podzines. Yes, hello everybody and welcome once again to another podzine, and I'm afraid it's going to be the last in our regular weekly series, mainly because I've run out of time and the weather is just too fabulous at the moment to spend all the time stuck in front of a computer, in front of a screen, and all the background work that goes into doing the podzines as well as trying to run a business as well. So what I've decided to do is pull back on the regular basis because the regular podzines on the, used to take me best part of a weekend to do, which obviously knocks a hole in my outdoor activities, and that's where I'd rather be, as enjoyable as it is to chat to people. I'm still going to be producing podzines, but they're just not going to be on a regular weekly basis, so and the competitions will be a bit hit and miss as well, but I do hope you've enjoyed the regular series up until now, and obviously enjoyed the winning the prizes. Now, at least quite a few people have taken the time to write in, which has been really nice, and of course we've got a fabulous prize to announce the winner of on this particular show, which is of course the Canon G9 camera. So what have you been up to? Well, I know I've been away for a couple of weeks from the last show that was put together. I've been doing the Cape Wrath Trail. I joined my friend Lee Wells up in Ullapool a couple of weeks ago, and we headed north up to Cape Wrath, partly as a warm-up for him before starting the TGO Challenge. We had surprisingly fantastic weather. The usual story in Scotland, you've got no idea really what you're going to hit, even though the weather forecast says might be okay, and we had the first couple of days of really depressing heavy rain. It was warm but heavy rain, and then we went into glorious sunshine, so I went expecting rain and pestilence and came back with a suntan, which is Scotland all over. And talking of the TGO challenge, Lee has now gone on to start doing that, and I had a couple of texts from him, and everything's fantastic and hunky-dory for him at the moment, and he's obviously warmed up. He's had a good week or so's walking and getting himself ready for the actual trip, but there are various other people doing it as well, some of which are online bloggers, and they're doing a sort of up-to-date or a fairly sort of up-to-date blogging diary as they go. And I just thought I would let people know, if they're interested in this, to where they can find the information. Now, it's quite interesting because when you consider it, this is probably the first challenge where it has been actively blogged all the way along. Beforehand, it's usually people putting diaries up or people like ourselves doing the podcasts and so on after the event, and people get a feel for it. But actually now, for the first time ever, you can hear and see and read all about it as it actually happens, which is gives it a new twist. So if you need some escapism, let me give you some websites to have a look at, and you can pick up some information. And now one particular guy who is interested in the other bloggers and what they're doing is Actoman. He's a well-known blogger in the community, and his website is Actoman, A-K-T-O-M-A-N .blogspot.com. And he's got a couple of entries there, recent entries, covering the 7 challenge bloggers who are blogging on a sort of a sporadic basis. And also a note there that Cameron McNeish has produced the first of what I presume might be a series of mini videos, which are available on his blog as well, showing the some of the people starting off at Malaig. He had obviously had a chat with some of the people and what their thoughts were. And it's just fascinating to sit and watch, and having experienced that particular start myself, it's a lovely place to go. The weather on there was on their side. The water was like a mill pond crossing a two in Inveree. But my, weren't some of them carrying a bit of a load? Good grief. Do go and have a look at the videos and get an idea of the range of gear that people take with them and just how much they appear to be carrying. There's it's a good excuse, if any at all, to go lightweight, and certainly it's a great part of the world, and a wonderful event. So if you're listening to this thinking about doing it perhaps next year, make sure you get the October issue of TGO magazine. We're all the details will be promoted in that. And of course, it's a special 30th anniversary next year as well. So I shall be putting my name down for that, and Rose, and I'm sure many other people will as well. And I think they're increasing the numbers from the established 300. So, as I say, pop along to Actoman's website, and you will see the various clips there and links to people. Failing that, you can go to the links page on the Outdoor Station. But Actoman has really got it all together, and he's keeping a very close eye on people, so that'll be quite interesting. And of course, the Bloggers Roundup, one of the bloggers, Darren Weird Darren, as he's known, is actually doing the challenge this time, so hence the reason the Bloggers Roundup's gone quiet as well. So looking forward into this show. Obviously, we've got the competition to announce. We'll have a look at the diary as usual. But we're talking Kurs this time. We're talking community, we're talking kayaks, and we're talking Cicerone. Andy Hull went to meet Mark Richards at the outdoor show at the NEC, who was just there to help launch the new book, The Great Mountain Days in the Lakes District. And of course, with this weather being the way it is, I'm sure many people will want to get up there and get out and explore the area with the help of a really good quality guidebook. The
Potsie. A couple of months ago, I was lucky enough to be in the Cicerone office talking to Mark Richards about a forthcoming book that looked as if it was going to be an absolute cracker, Great Mountain Days in the Lake District. And the book's available now. I'm sitting here with Mark, and we've got a copy of the book in our hands. Mark, it looks a fabulous book. Anybody that's really loves the Lake District, this is something for them, isn't it?
Well, I'm seriously hoping so. This is partly my idea and partly Jonathan Williams at Cicerone's idea. The idea that the area is very special, and the idea of packaging together a nice balanced view of all the really good days out on the fells. And it came to be as the title came to be as a natural thing, because it was the inspiration that I wanted the book to represent.
Now, when we think of your work, we do think a lot about graphics, and this takes the whole graphics feel into a kind of different dimension, doesn't it? The very strong photographic and graphical feel all the way through the book. So just explain to us what it is you've been trying to do with the photographs and the maps.
The book actually has its origins in my work that I was doing with Lakeland Fell Ranger, and that was its earlier genesis was purely pen and ink work, and that evolved when I first produced it with HarperCollins. They said get a lot of photographic material in it and try and make it far more balanced and more acceptable to the current tastes. So this book has evolved in that way very much, so that all my photographs are complemented by every walk has a little aerial diagram, a pen and ink diagram, which actually, because of the way I can process it on the computer, gives it a very colourful feel, and yet you can sense the hand-drawn element of it. But the whole concept includes a detailed Harvey map, which I have customised on my own computer, which is great fun to be able to do, to actually tamper with a map on your own computer.
I hope you had permission to do that.
Absolutely. And Harvey's maps are, to my mind, as good as any useful map on the open country and up on the fell.
Certainly agree with that.
And I think the way Cicerone have laid it out means you can not only see the walk, but you can actually think about adapting the walks and looking at different ways of using it. But the main thrust is to give people a really good walk that they will always enjoy, not too tiring, not too taxing, just to set them into them, get them to know about certain areas of the Lake District. The 50 walks cover all of the Lake District in certain sort of ways.
Now, each of the walks, we've got, in front of us, we've got Wetherlam from Coniston. Now, each of the walks has the map. It obviously has the usual breakdown of the walk, heights, distances, that kind of thing. Some lovely photographs. It really does give you a feel for the whole thing, doesn't it? Which makes this much more than a guidebook.
Yes, the basis of it, the notion behind it, is to inspire people to feel that they can feel the romance and the adventure of the place and know how they can achieve it. And it's not done to make you think you have to be a mountaineer to do it. I've divided the routes up into three levels: energetic, strenuous and arduous. The arduous actually is a longer walk where you might have to bring hands to rock. Strenuous is a bit longer walk. energetic as an average, good, easy fell walk that you can cope with even if the mist comes down. But most of the walks are designed to give you that feeling of adventure and the magic of the place and the heritage of the outdoors and the history that that is so innate, the quality that the Lake District has.
It's a very beautiful book, and it's part of this kind of emerging series that Cicerone are producing now, which is the kind of thing that you can sit and really enjoy at home, particularly during those cold, damp winter days. Fabulous, fabulous book. If you love the Lake District, then it's a book you're going to have on your bookshelf.
I would fancy so. If when I started fell walking some... How long ago is it now? I'm 59 now, and I started when I was in my early 20s properly. If I'd had this book then, oh, I'd have been thrilled. I know it's for people, it's aimed very much at that age group, in a sense, people who are coming new to it and thinking, they might have seen Julia Bradbury, for example, and thought, oh, that looks a nice place to go. How do I actually get there? How can I make it special? And because I've covered the walks from all over the area, if you're having a holiday in the North Lakes, you can go up Carrick Fell. If you're down in the South, you can go up Black Coombe. There's a walk for you wherever you're based, and it's the sort of book I'd have loved to have had when I started.
It certainly strikes me as being very collectible. Now, it's just about to hit the bookshops, and it's priced at...
$16.99.
Yeah, and it's a rather beautiful book, and it's not the kind of thing you'd slip in your pocket when you're out for a walk, but it certainly is
It's the new generation of Cicerone, basically, how they realise that being practical is what everybody wants, but to get them into the mode of thinking about what's special about the outdoors and what's special about given areas, the notion of having truly inspirational books that are not too unwieldy, but you can always refer to it. And it's a book to have always in your library, up in your shelves, to pop back to and have a look at from time to time.
Yeah, certainly, I suspect that's going to become a classic that will be read for many years to come. Now, that's just about to hit the bookshops, but there's another very exciting pictorial book that you're working on at the moment for later in the year.
Yes, well, of course, Cicerone are involved with doing revitalising my Fell Ranger series, but I'm also doing a very special one on Hadrian's Wall, Spirit of Hadrian's Wall, which will be coming out in September as well. That'll be the very first very big hardback Cicerone guide. Visuals essay, really. It uses the absolutely stunning photography of Roger Clegg, and I've got the lovely task of sort of drawing it all together and put it into context and perspective from Newcastle across to Carlisle. It's a wonderful historic landscape, not always appreciated by everybody who are walking the trail, who race across it. This book will actually have a timeless feel about it that will give you reason to think about coming to the Hadrian's Wall area again and again and draw out the wonderful heritage and history of the area.
I mean, that's right. I mean, we all know it's a historical area, but certainly when you're there, when you're on the ground, the breadth and scope of it always stuns you. No matter how much you think you know about the area in advance, it's a fabulous area. And there's something wonderfully mystical and slightly strange about those border areas anyway, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, frontiers, borders, I've always been a fascination of mine. I did my second guidebook I ever did, no, it's the third, come to think of it, was Offa's Dyke. And that I found a fascinating, rich landscape, a tapestry of interchanging twists and turns of hills and valleys and so forth. So that was a fascinating one. But Hadrian's Wall has got so much heritage in it that you can't... Because it stretches from 2,000 years ago and earlier right up to the present day. It's always been an interface. You can say after the Romans left, the first millennium itself, which we often think of as the Age of Arthur, it has its resonance throughout that border region. The earliest reference to Arthur was at Arthurich in long time, where 535 AD, earliest date in Scottish history, and Arthur was slain, and Merlin was enraged. But actually, the forerunner was actually Lucius Attorus Castus, who was a legionary officer based at Castlesteads, Cambellana, on the wall, So we've got this early reference to an iconic heroic figure that has its roots in Rome, but actually continued right throughout the subsequent years, and of course into the Border Reaver times when tyranny was apparent. But you've got so much, there's all these buildings and evidence of in that landscape that harks back to all this friction and mix of human emotion that the area represents.
Well, there you go. Two books. The Lake District book. Rush out and buy that now because it'll inspire you for those lovely long summer days up in the lakes. And in September, we can look forward to a winter of marvelling about Hadrian's Wall.
Absolutely.
I certainly think there's something very compelling about that mixture of the landscape, the walking, and the history and the cultural background. So yes. Good luck with those, Mark.
It's brilliant. And all these things help individuals feel their part in this landscape as part of that ongoing heritage. And walking in it and referring to the guidebooks that Cicerone produced are part and parcel of that.
OK, well, good luck for the lecture this afternoon, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you, Andy. Bye.
You know, in the industry at the moment, it's quite interesting, the number of people that are having problems getting their products, which have been mainly, in fact, pretty well all produced in China, into the UK. I know of at least five companies who are all late, as far as they're concerned, getting their products here. Here we are now at the beginning of May, middle of May, and normally the products would be here and on the shelves by end of March, beginning of April. It does make you wonder at the moment whether China are starting to hold the British outdoor industry, in fact any outdoor industry wherever you are in the world really, to ransom, because they've got control of pretty well everything. Certainly some products we've been involved with are 2 months behind a delivery date. I was speaking to somebody else today who have got exactly the same problem from a very well-known brand. So do consider that when you're looking around at the moment and you can't get hold of equipment you've read about, you've seen the PR4 and the publications and so on, you can't get hold of it. Just bear in mind that at the moment, I think the outdoor industry, just one of several industries, is actually struggling to get the stuff in, and it does make you think whether now is the time for the UK manufacturing industry to regenerate itself. It's pretty difficult in this country to do that due to overheads and so on, but with China apparently putting their prices up between 12% and 20%, and also started to hold everybody to ransom, it does make you wonder whether now is the time for the cottage industries or the smaller manufacturing units to really get a grip and look at this as an industry for potential product development. Now, one particular person that is making products in the UK is Glyn Edwards. He makes handmade hand-built wooden kayaks. I keep canoes is wrong word. Kayaks. And they're beautiful. They're a real work of art. Obviously, a lot of hours in them. They're not cheap, but they certainly are a thing of beauty and very, very practical. And I spoke to Glyn at the kayak show earlier on in the year, and he told me the story behind his change of career and exactly how it's going, being the only person in the UK making hand-built wooden kayaks.
Well, that's correct, yes. I make the sea kayaks, and also I design and build specialist sort of bespoke boats as well.
Now, when you say you design and build them, we're not talking about any other material apart from good old-fashioned wood, are we?
Oh, yes, just wood. Wood and some epoxy to keep the water out.
Yeah. Well, the workmanship in the products I'm looking at the moment, particularly seeing the smaller fun kayaks and so on made from that product, it's just such a unique look.
Well, each strip is cut by hand using a carving knife and a plane and laid individually. But that's what gives you the lovely sort of curved shapes and the flowing lines.
Just as, I mean, before we actually talk about the actual product itself and how you make it and so on and so forth, as an actual canoe, as a kayak, how do they perform differently?
Yes. Well, they perform really, really well because any kayaker will know that sort of the more rigid the boat, the better it handles because you don't get any flex. But with the accompaniment of wood and epoxy, they're one of the most rigid build methods you can get. So take the sea kayak, it'll just ride over the top of waves instead of a plastic boat that'll just sort of like fold into them. And the surf kayaks, the rails are so solid that you'll just get no flex as you're doing a bottom turn, and it'll just shoot you up. So it's a much more crisp, flowing feeling.
Now, you're making really bespoke boats here, really bespoke kayaks. I take it the whole process is custom built to the person's build, size, weight, etc.
Exactly. The sea kayaks, not so much, because they are quite big, so they will accommodate quite a few people. However, the surf kayaks were actually built for two clients. And when I designed it, I actually sat them on the floor and measured the distance from their hip to their knee to their ankle, the size of their feet, so that we knew that the boats would fit them precisely. So these boats are their boats. They're, you know, and if somebody else wanted one, I would go through that same process and build a boat to suit those. So one of the problems I've had, somebody have told me, is that they'd like to get a surf boat, but they can't fit. They're too big. Mm. Many of the surf boats are quite small. Mm. So what I would do, I just say, come here, I'll build you a bigger one.
Mm. Well, it sounds so easy, but I mean, I'm just watching a visitor here to the stand. You know, it's such a tactile material, isn't it? People just want to come and touch.
Oh, everybody has walked past and they've all touched and smoothed it and said, oh, isn't it lovely? But I think there's something about wood and human beings. People just love the look and the feel of wood. Mm. And they all come up and touch it and smooth it. And what with the polished finish as well, they really do enjoy touching it.
It's a unique thing. And when you're actually using this out on the water, do you find people actually stop and talk to you because you're using this?
Yes, they do. You know, when I'm sort of taking it off the top of the car, you just get a crowd of people around you. And they wondered what it was, because, you know, especially in Britain, they've never seen this thing before, because it's sort of predominantly a North America and Canadian sort of phenomenon, the Cedar Strip. But in Britain, they all wonder what it is, because it's a beautiful-looking thing as well. But many people think it's impractical, but they couldn't be more wrong, really, because it's a very tough, very practical boat.
And it's also lighter as well, I understand.
It is, yeah. It's the standard sea kayak there weighs 18.5 kilos, and the surf kayak's about 11 kilos. That's sort of generally sort of glass fiber weight, if not lighter.
Mm. Well, first of all, I must congratulate you being a UK company making in the UK, which isn't going to be cheap, I know, but there again, people are going to be getting a really top-quality product. Just talk me a bit through the actual time it takes and the work involved, if you would.
Right, well, the sea kayak takes probably about 3 months to build, and the surf kayaks, well, much the same, because of the actual complexity in getting the wood to bend and the joints to cut. You know, it takes quite a long time. And then also the finish. Now, you the fiberglass goes on, then you have to rub that down, then you have to paint it, have to polish that up. So it takes, you know, several weeks just to finish it.
Wow. And the actual process of putting it all together, I mean, do you have a large workshop or sort of are you working around the kitchen table?
Basically, well, I've got a workshop, let's put it that way. And the workshop is actually about 4 foot longer than the sea kayak.
Oh, really?
And it just fits in. It's quite a small affair, but then I'm a one-man band, and I just sort of, I've got that personal touch. Whereas, in fact, the one that we're looking at now was a guy came into the workshop as I was building it, and he said, yes, I want it. And at that point, then I said, well, would you like to choose the pattern in it? So, oh, that'd be great. So he was actually in the workshop helping build his kayak.
Fantastic.
Now, you can't do that in the Middle East.
No, you certainly can't, can you? And how old is that kayak? Because it looks brand new.
It's 2 years old.
Never.
It is. It's 2 years old. And the guy, a friend of mine, he doesn't look after it that well, and he actually seal launches it on gravelly beaches, which I think, oh, my God. But if he was to look at the bottom, yes, there's some scratches in the paint, but that's it. And the joy of this, because there is so much lacquer on it, after, say, 5-6 years, and you think, oh, it's looking a little bit tired, you just sand it down, put some more paint on, and it's brand new again.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, actually. I mean, you know, that's... It's very hard, isn't it? Because the product itself looks such a pristine thing of beauty, and such an elegant item. You sort of like be scared to use it in case you damage it. But from what you're saying, it's actually probably more durable than a lot of the modern fabric boats.
Yeah, definitely.
But if you were to have a serious accident that gave you a nasty mark or more in your hull, it's easy to repair, I presume.
Yes, it is. Well, if it were really that bad to have to actually hole it, all you do is you cut out that piece, put some more wood in, glass fibre inside and out, polish it in, and you wouldn't even notice it. Because it's made of strips, you could actually fit the strips in so they would look nice. But as an example, The guy who owns it, again, he seal launched it down a wooden slipway, and as he was sliding down the slipway, a piece of flint was stuck in the hole, and it scraped the whole length of the boat underneath. This horrible noise. And we thought, oh my God, what's going to happen here? And then when we turned the board over, all it had done, it had just scratched a bit of the paint. And that was a piece of a hooked flint in the slipway. And I thought, well, you really have to give it some abuse to break it. Yeah. You really would.
Well, I think you've convinced me on the sales pitch, but I'm frightened now. I'm frightened now when you tell me the prices. Just give people an idea, an approximation, because obviously this will be live for some time to come, an idea of the sort of prices we could be looking at for something like this.
Well, the Sea Kayak is about £3,500. But what you've got to bear in mind is that because it takes me about 3 months to build, I did actually work it out, and I'm working actually for about £4.50 an hour. So it's a minimum wage kayak.
Right.
But I do love doing it, so as long as I can get by and okay. eat, I'm quite happy.
And the surf kayaks?
These are £3,000.
Right.
But the thing with the kayak, they could, because these ones are designed for a particular person, if you wish to have some slight changes due to the size of your legs, your feet, whatever, then what I'll do then is, if there's more design work, then I will charge per hour for the design work. But then, in that case, you are getting a completely unique bespoke boat for yourself. It's like a Savile Row kayak.
Yeah. And have you found the people that come to the show today, they've appreciated the work that's gone into this?
Oh, yes, everybody's appreciated. You know, almost everybody's walked past and said, my God, how wonderful. Mm. One of the things I get, which is they'd say, oh, I'm too scared to take it in the water. And I just think that's terrible because it's a kayak, it wants to be in the water. And it looks so much better with water running off it. Because it's a beautiful craft to paddle. And as we just said earlier, it's very robust. And then if you did scratch it, you can just put a bit more paint on it. You can't do that on a plastic boat.
So what's happening soon in the great outdoors? The Podzine Diary.
Glyn Edwards there from Glyn Edwards Kayaks, and there'll be links to his website from the show notes attached to this on theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Okay, so let's have a look at the diary. We're going over to the diary page over at the Outdoor Station, the What's on Diary. I noticed that as I've been away for a couple of weeks, I've been a little bit remiss. April needs to be removed. We're already halfway through May, virtually. And so let's pick up pretty well on today's date, the 13th of May, going into the 14th. And, of course, we've got the Festival of Harbour Walks at Chichester Harbour and the very well-known and famous Cumberland Ale Keswick Mountain Festival for the next 4 days, which is normally very, very popular, and it's been very well publicised in most of the outdoors magazines. Now, if you fancy a seaside stroll, join the Macmillan Cancer Support Unit this weekend. Where are they doing it? From Frenchman's Bay, which is... Join us at the Souter Lighthouse. Oh, South Tyneside. So there's a good walk for you there. Very sociable, I'm sure, as well, for a good cause. And, of course, so this weekend we've got the Aviemore Film Festival. We've got the Ballater Royal Deeside Walking Festival. We've got the Lincolnshire Wolds Walking Festival. And unusual one, this, probably for bushcraft people, is the UK Knife Show on the Sunday. It's just a short show, but it's at Wootton Under Edge in Gloucestershire. Again, you can see the details from it on the diary page, but there's tickets and telephone number there to get in. It's £5 to get in, or if you need to rent a table to sell something, that might be of interest to the bushcraft community. Next week, Walk to School Week. Oh, that should be good. Now let's move on. More festivals of walk, really. I mean, basically, the end of May seems to be filled with walking festivals. And if this weather holds out at the moment, it's going to be absolutely fabulous. Lots of warm shoulders and warm necks and sore feet, I'm sure. 23rd of May, Llanelli Festival of Walks. 24th, Across Ross Charity Walk. Pot Walloping Festival at Westwood Ho. That sounds quite good fun. It's a traditional festival, recently revived, of throwing back the pebbles that have fallen from the ridge during the winter storms. And I'm sure there's a big social event attached to that, so that's quite interesting. And there's a website to look at there. Then you've also got the Warwickshire Walking Festival. We've got the world-famous asparagus auction. I missed the opening part of that, so I'll try and get to that one if I can. Then in Worcestershire, we have Country Crafts on the 26th of May. Anglesey have got their walking festival on the 26th of May, and Angus Glen's walking festival on the 29th. Finally, at the end of May, 30th of May, we've got the 4th Himalayan Festival, which takes place in Manchester Town Hall. So there's plenty there. Do go and have a look at the diary page on the outdoor station. And there's a lot to get involved in around the UK. Going into June, once again, there's kicking off lots of walking festivals. See, Malvern, my hometown here, has got a walking festival on the 6th of June. I might see if I can get up there and have a chat with a few people doing that. That should be quite interesting. And then nearby, Evesham, Morris and Medieval and Cider Festival. Well, as it's local, I think I should, really, shouldn't I? 14th of June. Treat that with great respect, though, I think. And then we go into Green Transport Week on the 16th of June. So there's plenty going on. On the 21st of June, just to finish off, there's the Summer Solstice Dusk Walk. And that's from Wyre Forest Visitor Centre near Bewdley in Worcestershire. As I say, all the details, all the contact details and websites and whatever else are on the diary page on the outdoorstation.co.uk. Right, let us move on to our next interview. At the Outdoor Show, Andy Howell spoke to Robin Ashcroft about the charity Community Action Nepal, which has been founded by mountaineer Doug Scott to improve the health and education of the communities that support mountaineering expeditions.
The Podzine Diary.
One of the most important things about the outdoor world, I think, is the connection between the growing community and the landscape and the people who live there, and a growing understanding of the importance of contributing to sustainable communities. And nowhere can we see that more impressively, perhaps, than in Nepal. And with me is Robin Ashcroft from Community Action Nepal, which is a very, very impressive initiative that was started by mountaineer Doug Scott.
Yeah.
Which is looking to improve the life for ordinary Nepalese people. So, Robin, just tell us a bit about the background of Community Action.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's quite an old organisation. It originally started, I think, somewhere in the region about 30 years ago with an organisation called Community Action Treks. And basically, how this started was, I mean, Doug was really at the height of his sort of mountaineering career there, having just made the first British ascent of Everest, of course, by the Everest Southwest Face, Everest the Hard Way. And in subsequent exhibitions, the penny suddenly dropped that these guys were paying quite considerable sums of money to Nepalese managers to recruit the high-altitude porters, which, absolutely essential for supplying the expedition with its food, paraffin, you know, all the wherewithal of life. And they suddenly realized that although they were handing over quite large sums of money, none of this was actually trickling down to the people who carried the loads. And, you know, I mean, these guys were carrying, you know, in excess of 40 pounds over extremely rugged terrain. And basically, I think Doug was just absolutely furious. So with a number of fellow mountaineers, he formed Community Action Treks, which in effect was a trekkers cooperative. And he worked with the local porters, who in the main came not from the Sherpa community, but from the Middle Hill tribes, and instituted a system where they worked for themselves. And, you know, there was an input in terms of management and guidance, and they made sure that there were proper standards so the people who were paying the money, the trekkers, got a good deal. But the porters themselves were properly equipped, you know, with boots, with windproof, waterproof clothing, made sure they had some shelter at night time. And, you know, that was a good deal, and everybody ran all the way around. And over a number of years, what happened is that the porters themselves got to be incredibly proficient, and, you know, surprise, surprise, they were probably better at running themselves than we were running with them. So Community Action Treks continuing. But out of that grew Community Action Nepal, which, I mean, as most of your listeners will be aware, Nepal is one of the poorest countries on the planet. And it was decided that working in conjunction, as they've done with Community Action Treks, to fund a number of projects within the villages, particularly up in the mountains, to try and improve their standard of life. And we're talking very much grassroots projects. We work very closely with the local villagers through their structure, through the headmen. We ask them what they want. We don't try to impose upon them what we think they want.
And in a sense, a lot of the original initiative came, didn't it, from people who were saying, well, actually, we need to do something about education, we need to do something about basic health care in our community.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. I mean, you know, Community Action Nepal is often referred to as a mountaineer's charity. Now, you know, we're very happy for people to contribute who are not mountaineers. But I think it largely came out of the affection that we as mountaineers feel for Nepal. I mean, you know, we go there to climb these stupendous mountains, and Nepal has the biggest concentration of 8,000-metre peaks on the planet. Because we get to know and live with, and I think affection is really the right word for the local people, because everybody who's involved with CAN very much says the same thing. Although you know, we're arranging for money to go into the villages, actually, we're getting as much out of it just living and working and knowing these people, because they have such a refreshing view on life. I mean, you know, we live in the West, life is incredibly complicated, and, you know, I don't think there's anybody who ever comes away, myself included, thinking, you know, who's got the right sense of priorities and who's really benefiting from this.
Yes, I mean, I've not been to Nepal myself yet, I'm desperate to go, but I was out having a meal just a couple of nights ago with a friend of mine who's just come back, and had exactly the same kind of experience of that wonderful, enchanting hospitality. So when we're talking about the kind of investments we've made, I mean, what's the scale of the impact that we've had in terms of those hillside communities?
It's considerable. I mean, the charity has funded over 40 projects in 14 years. The bulk of them, I mean, it's very basic stuff, such as getting a school into an area, getting a medical centre into an area. I mean, even stuff as basic as laying 6 miles of pipe, which actually, given the terrain out there, is a very major feat of achievement, you know, to bring fresh water into the villages, clean water into the villages, because, you know, this is absolutely critical to basic health. But it's all focused around giving them stuff. I know it's the stuff that we'd often take for granted, but, you know, a good education means so much to the people over there. I mean, and what we also insist on with any project, this isn't a one-way thing. We not only talk to the villagers, but it's part of the planning. We feel that they should have ownership of the project. I mean, what we're very concerned about is not engendering the culture of donor dependency. I mean, that's absolutely fatal. So that if we agree to put a project in, the village has to contribute a third to it. Now, that may be things are new. I mean, for instance, like everybody in the village bringing in the slates to roof a school, so that they've made a contribution and they're part of that project. But it's not just building the project, and it's all very well putting in a school, it's all very well putting in a medical post, but without the teachers to staff it or the nurses, you know, to work with the locals, you know, to give them the medical advice, it's a pointless exercise.
So it's got to be about sustainability and security in the most genuine terms.
Absolutely. It is very easy, relatively easy, to build a building. But it's putting the organisation into place. But it's even, you know, we need to think beyond that. If we're educating young Nepalese, you know, if we are instilling family planning, we have an ongoing responsibility, because that changes their lives. Now, it's all very well having educated Nepalese in these villages if they've got nothing to do. You know, you educate a person, and if they can't make use of that education, frustration is going to set in, and you have a major problem. So we're looking at not only educating them, but helping them to acquire skills which are actually useful within their community. And, you know, in many ways, it's gone full circle, because, you know, Community Action Nepal is helping raise the standards, all by a relatively small amount, but it really makes a difference in the day-to-day life of the guys over there. But, I mean, somebody asked me the other day, what's the best way to help in Nepal? Is it to donate money, or is it to go on a trek over there? And I'm absolutely clear about this. It's going on a trek. I mean, it's great, you know, donate the money. That is brilliant. But, you know, this is not like Burma. There is not, well, there is a political issue in Nepal, but they're resolving it. But if you go on a trek, you're bringing money into the local economy. But what you're doing is enabling a business, and these people are earning they're earning the money for themselves, and you've got an ongoing facility that will stay with them for the rest of their lives.
I mean, this is the theme I think that's growing right across the outdoors world at the moment. The notion that, well, maybe we've got to modify the old John Muir maxim, you know, sometimes perhaps you do want to leave an impression or a trace on a community, but it has to be the right kind of investment, the right kind of the right kind of contact, in a sense that promotes that notion of sustainable well-being.
One thing that we're all very keen on, and you know, there are parallels with life in this country. I mean, Community Action Nepal is based in Cumbria. A lot of the people who live and work, myself included, you know, make our homes in Cumbria. And I think it's very important that we recognise that this is not just the first world trying to resolve the problems of the third world. We have problems too. In Cumbria, there is a problem with keeping young people in the community. You know, houses are very expensive up here. You know, there's also a similar problem in Nepal, and there is this national drift away to the city, the bright lights of the city. It's breaking up families, it's breaking up communities. So our view is that, you know, inherently, the culture that the mountain people have developed over hundreds, if not thousands of years, living in this very demanding environment, you know, they have developed a very effective structure, and we should really be encouraging them to stay in their homes.
So it's very important to realise this is a two-way process. I mean, yes, we're investing in the futures of this phenomenal community, but they've got a lot to teach us back in return.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're all starting to ask this question now. You know, how sustainable is Western civilization? And the reality is it's not sustainable. You know, we've got global warming. We were talking about oil peak. Some say in the next 5 years, some say in the next 10. But it's going to happen at some stage. So, you know, this absolute reliance that technology will always provide the problems may not always be the case. And, you know, our whole economy is framed around ever-increasing economic growth. And, you know, that is not going to go on indefinitely. So many of the approaches, and it's tied in with the culture and the philosophy that they've had in addressing very real problems. These may be problems that we have to face in the close future, and, you know, we need to learn from them. It's a two-way thing.
Now, of course, for many, many hill walkers, I guess the ultimate experience for them is that once-in-a-lifetime, or maybe twice-in-a-lifetime trip to Nepal. We're not suggesting that they don't do that. In fact, actually encouraging people to do that, but engage when you're there in the right kind of way. And it still represents, I guess, the most phenomenal experience that a hill walker can have.
Absolutely. I mean, the Himalaya are just incredible. I've climbed throughout the world, and the Himalaya just leave you absolutely speechless. But actually, the interesting thing, I mean, I went to the Himalaya relatively late in my mountaineering career, and it was a real eye-opener for me, because for a long time, and I don't know, so I suppose middle age really, up until my middle age, I'd always been more interested in landscape. Yeah, and, you know, you go for the landscape. Let's be clear about this, because it is, you know, it will just blow you away. But actually, what I came away being much more interested in was being able to spend time with the Nepalese, with the hill people. And it was fascinating. Their culture was interesting. It was stimulating. Yeah, they're intelligent, friendly people. They're a real breath of fresh air. And, yeah, it shifted my emphasis as to why I go into the hills.
Well, it certainly sounds a fascinating initiative, and certainly the stand is packed full of useful information. These days, everybody's on the web, so if somebody wants to learn more about the work of Community Action Nepal, where do they look?
www.cattreks.org.
Okay, well, Robin, it's a fascinating, worthwhile project, and I wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you very much.
Well, my thanks to everyone who has taken part in the show, and of course there will be links in the show notes to the various websites associated with the interview. So that was just to remind you, with Mark Richards, Glyn Edwards and Robin Ashcroft from Community Action Nepal. And thanks to Andy Howell, of course, as well. Anyway, the last show that we did, we had a competition, which was to win a fabulous £400 Canon G9 camera, which has been donated courtesy of Canon. And we'd like to thank them very much indeed for that. As you might expect, as the podzine, the previous podzine's been live for a couple of weeks, we've had a record number of entries, and not surprising considering the value of the camera, of course. And well over 300 people have answered the question. And the question was, what is the size of the 12 megapixel camera sensor? What is the size of the sensor on the G9? The answer of which could be found on the Canon website. And it is, of course, now I'm not too sure actually how to say this. I see it on the screen, but do I read that as 1 1/7 of an inch? Anyway, if people put the right text in, I accepted the answer, and as I said, we had well over 300 correct answers. So they're all in the machine for a very, very random pull-out, and I wish everyone the best of luck while we press the final button and get the machine to produce the winner. Yes, and we have a winner, and the winner is... Yes, the winner is Hamish McGill from Bromsgrove near Birmingham. Congratulations, Hamish. You are now the proud owner of a Canon G9 worth almost £400. And thank you to everyone who entered that competition. It is a random out-of-the-hat draw competition. And congratulations to Hamish. That'll be going off to you the next couple of days, and I'm sure you'll have hours of pleasure from that during the forthcoming year. So thanks to everybody for contributing to the show, for those who obviously were on the interviews, all the people that have been on the previous podzines, to all the sponsors of the competitions. Thank you very much indeed for your donations, and also for everybody for entering the competitions as well. As I say, these it isn't the end of all the podzines, it's just the end of the weekly podzines to try and give me some time back to do a few other things, like get out and enjoy the outdoors, which is what it's all about in the first place. And I shall be bringing you a whole range of new programmes as the week go by. I've got plenty in the bag already and more to be doing. So do stay tuned to make sure you're linked to our RSS feed on iTunes, or keep visiting back the outdoor station, where of course you can have a look at the links page and the diary page to see what's going on, to give you some inspiration to get out and enjoy it more. Until next time, folks, take care and enjoy the summer.
The program has been brought to you by the Outdoor Station.co.uk.